colonialism, the taking of the land, the taking of the resources, displacing the local population and replacing it. This has been a feature. Now, it is in this context that we need to analyze what is happening today. And by the way, don't listen only to Francesca Albanese, listen to what these Israeli leaders and ministers are saying. Reoccupying Gaza, retaking Gaza, recolonizing Gaza, reconquesting Gaza. This is what they are saying, and there are settlers on expeditions, not only to Gaza, but also to Lebanon. So this is why I said that the main difference, the main feature of this genocide, apart all the horrible aspects of it, is that this is the first settler colonial genocide to be ever litigated before a court, an international court. And this is why coming to this country, which is a country birthed from a genocide, when I meet the Native Americans, for example, I feel the pain of these people. And I say, if we manage to build on the intersectionality of indigenous struggle, the cry for justice behind this case for Palestine will resonate even louder, because it will somewhat be an act of atonement from the settler colonial endeavor, which has sprouted out of Europe, toward indigenous people. So there is a lot of symbolism behind it.
And, you know, the analogy, first of all, you talked about the case brought by South Africa, so that what they share, apart from South Africa and Israel, Palestine, is both the fact that they were colonial settler states, as well as the fact that apartheid has been established as having occurred in both places. Now, in the case of South Africa, it was a decision that was taken by the United Nations at the time of apartheid, was unseating South Africa from the General Assembly. There have been calls now to do the same with Israel. So if you could comment on that, and then I just want to quote another short sentence from your report, in which you say, as the world watches the first live-streamed settler colonial genocide, only justice can heal the wounds that political expedience has allowed to fester. So if you could talk about the International Court of Justice's case in that context, what role you think they can play, South Africa's case, in resolving or addressing, seeing and addressing this wound?
First of all, let me unpack the question of the unseating Israel, because this is one of the recommendations I made in my report on the Article 6 of the UN Charter. A member state can be suspended of its credentials, of its membership, by the General Assembly upon recommendation of the UN Security Council. And the first criticism I got is that we cannot do that because every state commit international law violations. Absolutely, absolutely. But there are two striking features here. First, Israel is quite unique in maintaining an unlawful occupation, which has deemed such by, in at least one full occasion, but again, there was already a case brought before the ICJ in 2004. So there have been two ICJ advisory opinion. There is a pending case for genocide. There has been the violations of hundreds of resolutions by the on Israel, occupied Palestinian territory, by the Security Council, the General Assembly, the Human Rights Council, and steady violation of international humanitarian law, human rights law, the apartheid convention, the genocide convention. So this is quite unique. But all the more, this year alone, Israel has conducted an attack, an unprecedented attack against the United Nations. It has attacked physically through artillery, weapons, bombs, UN premises, 70% of UNRWA offices on UNRWA buildings, clinics, distribution centers have been hit and shelled by the Israeli army. 230 UN staff members have been killed by Israel in Gaza alone. UN peacekeepers in Lebanon have been attacked. And this doesn't even take into account the smear, the defamation against senior UN officials, the declaration of the Secretary General as persona non grata, the referring to the General Assembly as a cloak of anti-Semites. again, this has mounted to a level, the hubris against the United Nations and international law has been unchecked and unbounded forever. But now, especially after the Knesset passed a law outlawing UNRWA, declaring UNRWA a terrorist organization, and therefore disabling it from its capacity to deliver aid and assistance, especially in Gaza and the West Bank and East Jerusalem. This is the nail in the coffin of the UN Charter, and it can also contribute to that sense of colonial erasure, because here it's not just at stake the function of a UN body, and UNRWA is a subsidiary body of the General Assembly, so it's even more serious. But there is the capacity of UNRWA to deliver humanitarian aid in a desperate situation, and also the fact that UNRWA is seen by Israel as the symbol of Palestinian identity, especially the Palestinian refugees. So there is an attempt to erase Palestinianness, including by hitting UNRWA.
I want to ask you about your trip here as we begin to wrap up. The U.S. ambassador to the United Nations, Linda Thomas-Greenfield, tweeted on Tuesday, as U.N. Special Rapporteur Albanese visits New York, I want to reiterate the U.S. belief she's unfit for her role. The United Nations should not tolerate anti-Semitism from a U.N.-affiliated official hired to promote human rights. If you can further address their charge of anti-Semitism against you, and talk about what happened. You were supposed to come to Congress and speak and brief them, but that was canceled this week.
Yes, it was canceled, but let me. First of all, I'm very embarrassed to read this, because a senior U.S. official who writes this, I mean, it shows a little bit of desperation. I'm sorry, but this, you know, I'm very candid. And let me unpack my anti-Semitism for the audience. So what I've been accused, the reason why I've been accused of anti-Semitism is because I've allegedly compared the Jews to the Nazis. Never done. What I've done is saying, and I keep on saying, that history is repeating itself. I've never done such a comparison. Where I draw the parallel is on the behavior of member states who have the legal and moral obligation to prevent atrocities, including an unfolding genocide. In the past, they have done nothing until the end of the Second World War to prevent the genocide of the Jews and the Roma and Sinti. And they've done nothing to prevent the genocide of the Bosnians. And they've done nothing to prevent the genocide of the Rwandans. And they're doing the same today. This is where I insist. And now, compared to when there was the Holocaust, now we have a human rights framework that should prevent this. The Genocide Convention should prevent this. So this is one of the points. The second point, because which leads to portray me as an anti-Semite, which is really, really offensive, is that I've said that the October 7 was not, I've contested, I've challenged the argument that October 7 was an anti-Semitic attack. October 7 was a crime, was heinous, and again, I've condemned the acts that were directed against Israeli civilians and expressed solidarity with the victims, with the families. I've been in contact with the families of the hostages. But I've also said the hatred that led that prompted that attack, to the extent it hit civilians, not the military, but it was prompted not by the fact that Israelis are Jews, but the fact that the Israelis are part of that endeavor that has kept the Palestinians in a cage for 17 years, and before under martial law for 37 years. And Palestinians have tried, it's true, they've used violence, but before violence, they've tried dialogue, they've tried collaboration, they've tried a number of means, access to justice, and they've gone nowhere. Let me relate to just this case, because last year I worked with children, and someone who was 17 years old before October 7 last year had never set foot out of Gaza. This is the reality. And I spoke with children while I was writing my report on unchilding the experience of Palestinians under Israeli occupation. And one of them, I mean, there were these two girls fighting because one of them had been able to go to Israel and the West Bank because she had cancer and could be treated. And the other was jealous because she said at least she was sick and she could go, she could travel. I've never seen the mountains. And again, this doesn't justify violence, but please, please put things in context. And even Israeli scholars have said, claiming that October 7 was prompted by anti-Semitism is a way to decontextualize history and to deresponsabilize Israel. I condemn Israel, not because it's a Jewish state, it's not about that, but because it's in breach of international law through and through. And were the majority of Israelis Buddhist, Christians, atheists, it would be the same. I would be as vocal as I am now.
Francesca, just one last question. We only have a minute. Your recent book, J'accuse, you take the title, of course, from the letter Emile Zola wrote during the Dreyfus affair to the French president. You came under severe criticism for the choice of that title. Could you explain why you chose it and what it means in this context?
Absolutely. I have the tendency, I have the sense that whatever I say comes under scrutiny and criticism. But J'accuse is, first of all, the title that was proposed by the editor, the publisher, and I was against it until October 7, when I saw the narrative, the dehumanization of the Palestinians after October 7 and what it was legitimized. I said, this is the title. We need to use it because I draw the parallel between what is happening to the Palestinians and what has happened to other groups, particularly the Jewish people in Europe. I said Holocaust was not just about the concentration camps. The Holocaust was a culmination of centuries of discrimination, and the previous decades had led the Jewish people in Europe to be kicked out of jobs, professions, to be treated like subhumans, as animals. And this dehumanization that we need to look at in the face today, in the eyes today, and recognize as leading to atrocity crimes.
We want to thank you for being with us, Francesca Albanese, UN Special Rapporteur on the Occupied Palestinian Territory. Coming up, the race for the White House. We'll speak to Ohio State Senator Nina Turner and the Reverend William Barber of the Poor People's Campaign. He's in North Carolina. Back in a minute.
The Son of Life. I've got the right. With another Son of Life. I've got the right. With another Son of Life. I've got the right. With another person, but not actually touching. The Son of Life. I've got the right. With another Son of Life. I've got the right. With another Son of Life. I'm fighting with another person, but not actually touching.
I'm talking post future. I'm talking resilience and levitation. I'm talking beauty and structural integrity for my people. I'm talking light beams that tell stories and educate. Let's talk about that if you want to talk.
Fighting with another sort of life. Fighting with another sort of life. Fighting with another person, but not actually touching.
New future. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
We turn now to the race for the White House. Republican presidential candidate Donald Trump continues to escalate his rhetoric on the campaign trail ahead of Election Day.
And my people told me about 4 weeks ago, I was saying, no, I want to protect the people. I want to protect the women of our country. I want to protect the women. Sir, please don't say that. Why? They said, we think it's We think it's very inappropriate for you to say, "Say why? I'm president. I want to protect the women of our country." They said. They said, "Sir, I just think it's inappropriate for you to say, pay these guys a lot of money. Can you believe it?" I said, "Well, I'm going to do it whether the women like it or not. I'm going to protect them. I'm going to protect them from migrants coming in. I'm going to protect them from foreign countries that want to hit us with missiles and lots of other things."
That was Donald Trump speaking in Green Bay, Wisconsin. Democratic presidential candidate Kamala Harris shared Trump's comments on X and wrote, quote, "Donald Trump thinks he should get to make decisions about you, what you do with your body, whether you like it or not." Harris also spoke about Trump's record as president at a campaign rally in Madison, Wisconsin.
"We hand-selected three members of the United States Supreme Court with the intention, that they would undo the protections of Roe v. Wade. They did as he intended. And now in America, one in three women lives in a state with a Trump abortion ban. Many with no exceptions, even for rape and incest, which is immoral. Immoral. And look, Donald Trump's not done. He would ban abortion nationwide."
Constitutional amendments to expand or protect abortion access are on the ballot in 10 states, including the battleground states of Arizona, Nevada, and Florida. This week, a group of 82 U.S. Nobel Prize winners signed an open letter endorsing Harris, arguing a Trump presidency would, quote, "jeopardize any advancements in our standards of living, slow the progress of science and technology, and impede our responses to climate change." Also this week, more than 1,000 religious leaders endorsed Harris.
We're joined now by one of those religious leaders in Raleigh, North Carolina. Bishop William Barber is the national co-chair of the Poor People's Campaign, president and senior lecturer of Repairers of the Breach, founding director of the Center for Public Theology and Public Policy at Yale Divinity School. Welcome back to Democracy Now! Thank you so much, Bishop Barber, for joining us. I know that your mom's health is challenged right now, so thank you again. I'm wondering if you can start off by talking about your decision in the last few days to endorse Vice President Harris as president of the United States, and talk about the reasons for it, what you think she's addressed and what you think she hasn't addressed and needs to.
Well, you know, Amy, first of all, thank you for having me on and thank you for your prayers. I'm an independent and I'm endorsing in my personal private capacity. The law allows, not with any of the organizations that were mentioned. Those were just for defining purposes. But as a moral leader and a biblicist, the scriptures are very clear. When there are moments you have to be focused and you cannot in any way be misunderstood. When I look at, for instance, in the Bible, in the book of Proverbs, Hebrews Bible, book of Proverbs, verse chapter 6, and you look at what it says, six things that God hates, even seven, and you read those seven things and you see a candidate committing them almost every day. That include a lying tongue, a proud look, running to mischief, and showing division among the people. When you go to the Gospels of Jesus, Jesus was clear about nations. He said that every nation would be judged by how we treat the least of these, the poor, the hungry, the sick, the imprisoned, and interestingly, the immigrants. And when you see a campaign, there's not violating that sometimes, but all the time, you have to make a clear moral stand. I've been out here for a long time. But when you see a fascist-leaning, lying, constitutional-breaking, rule of law, denying, misogynist, racist, mean spirit, women, health-taking and health-stealing, union-busting candidacy, there can be no middle ground, not in this moment. And that's why I've decided, and then many other moral leaders, Jews, Muslims, and Christians have decided as well. When we look at the campaign, lastly, we see Harris trying to unify. No person, even myself, we all have our personal flaws. None of us are perfect. But when we see clearly Harris trying to unify Trump, making more division, when we see Harris trying to say, I'm going to raise the minimum wage to a living wage, and Trump saying the minimum wage is already too high, promising more tax cuts to the greedy, saying that $7.25 is too high. When you see Harris saying, I want to expand health care, you hear Trump saying he wants to undermine health care. And when you see Harris saying, I want to expand voting rights and voter protections, but you hear Trump talking about undermining voting rights, undermining the 15th Amendment, and then hear him talking about undermining the 14th Amendment, giving equal protection under the law for all persons that are in this country. Those are very dangerous steps that which we have to challenge and which we have to be clear and which we have to have no middle ground.
And Bishop Barber, we're speaking to you in North Carolina. Could you talk about the significance of the state in this election and the fact that in 2016, as well as in 2020, Trump won the state?
He did, but one of the things that we pointed out in all of these so-called battleground states and even in the South, that many of these states are not red or blue as much as they are untapped and unorganized. Trump won in by 74,000 votes in the last election, but there were over 1 million poor and low-wage voters that did not vote. In Michigan, he won by some, in 2016, I think 10,000, over a million poor and low-wage voters weren't or didn't vote. In Pennsylvania, he won by 40,000, over 1.3 million poor and low-wage voters didn't vote. In 2008, Obama won North Carolina, and he only won 33 counties in North Carolina. He lost on Election Day, but he won through same-day registration and early voting, which our movement helped to fight for and put in place. And since that time, extremist Republicans have fought and tried to undermine same-day registration and early voting. We fought them in court and beat them. They were successful in getting a what we believe is an unconstitutional voter ID on the laws, and we're still fighting that now. But this state, if in fact a candidate fully reaches poor and low-wage voters and also campaigns in the East, beyond Raleigh, over in Rocky Mount and Greenville and Pasquotank County and Wilmington, is a state in which you can build a kind of coalition for more progressive candidates to win. We've said that clearly to the campaign, and early on we challenged them when we saw them going to Charlotte and Winston-Salem and Greensboro and not going to the East. We said, you have to go out East. You have to go in what's called the Black Belt, the Farm Belt, the place, interestingly, where many black and white people are joined together, particularly around issues of health care and issues of living wages. 39% of North Carolinian's workforce doesn't make a living wage of $15 an hour. So you have to speak directly to them and let them know if, in fact, you win, this is what's going to happen in their lives. So we believe, in fact, North Carolina is very much in this race. You've had a candidate for governor in the Republican arena who has really imploded and shown that the people that he was so vitriolic against, actually he himself was doing many of the things he was claiming is wrong. But even before that, his policies were just wrong. He was running for governor. He wanted to put women in jail for if they had an abortion. He was not promoting voting rights. He was supporting voter suppression. He was not supporting a living wage. He was not supporting fully funding public education. So even before the more personal things, his policies were bad. But we've got work to do. We've got a lot of work to do. Well, but North Carolina is always in the mix. It's a strange state. North Carolina is the only state in the last, say, 30 years or so that elected a Democrat for president, Jimmy Carter and Obama. And it's the only southern state that has consistently elected a Democrat for governor and a Democrat for AG, even when we had the fiasco of an extreme Republican takeover in 2012 due to voter suppression.
Bishop William Barber, we'll see what happens in the next few days, if in fact it is decided then, both at the local, state, and federal level. Bishop William Barber, co-founder of the Poor People's Campaign, director of the Center for Public Theology and Public Policy at Yale Divinity School, speaking to us from Raleigh, North Carolina. As we turn right now, also on the presidential race, to Nina Turner, former Ohio state senator, founder of We Are Somebody, which has been out talking to voters in Ohio about early voting, voting hours, voting the whole ballot. She is a senior fellow at the Institute on Race, Power, and Political Economy here at the New School. Her new piece for Newsweek is headlined, "Calling Trump a Nazi is Giving Our Own History a Pass. The Racism of MAGA is American." Nina Turner, unlike Bishop Barber, you have not actually endorsed your party's candidate, Kamala Harris. But if you can explain why, and then explain this piece, why you're saying what's happening in this country is uniquely American.
Well, for me, in this race, it's important to give the voters the depth and the breadth that they need to be able to make their own decisions. As you know, I was on a presidential campaign twice in 2016 and 2020, so I was actually out there stumping for my candidate, which was Senator Bernard Sanders. And this particular race, I mean, I'm feeling just as frustrated as most of the voters and the people that I've had the opportunity to talk to all over this country. People are really tired. They are exhausted. And we are going to have a lot of work to do after this election cycle. I'm more exhausted now than I was in 2016 and 2020, mentally and physically, although I am not on the campaign trail. In terms of my piece in Newsweek, it was important to set the stage that the MAGA movement itself, and not to say that all people in the movement are white supremacists or bigoted, but President Donald J. Trump has certainly set a stage by which the unfulfilled promises of this country, the undealt with anti-blackness and other types of racism and bigotry have not been dealt with sufficiently. And so it bubbles up to the top when you have someone like him that spreads that kind of stuff. And no one should be surprised. But I think when people lay this at the feet of Nazi Germany, oh, no, 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 wait a minute. And that's really what the crux of my piece was, is, oh, no, this is just as American as apple pie. And also when they do that, you diminish what happened to millions of people in Nazi Germany. And more importantly, you diminish the black liberation struggle right here on this soil, where a type of fascism, apartheid type activity, chattel slavery itself that deprived generations of black people from living out their greatest greatness, from rapes to lynchings to generational chattel, you diminish that and you say, this is not us. That piece was to say, no, it is us, and we need to deal with it and not push it off on some other nation.
And what are you hearing, Nina, from voters that you've been speaking to? What are their principal concerns?
The economy. I mean, that is the thing that I hear about the most. And I know now some numbers have come out. Gas prices are mysteriously lower now. Imagine that. I've had voters say that to me. But it really is the economy and how inflation has really siphoned off any advantages that working class people from all backgrounds have been trying so hard to change their material conditions, but they have not been able to get ahead.
And why haven't you made an endorsement?
I'm doing other work right now. You know, my one endorsement is not as important as the endorsement of voters all across this country. And I think sometimes people tend to put themselves ahead of what everyday voters need and want in this country. And so it is important to give the depth and the breadth to the voters. I am not on anybody's campaign trail. I was feeling it deeply in 2016 and 2020. And quite frankly, right now, I am not feeling it. And I am fed up. And I want it to be a clear unified, unattached voice for the struggles of working class people in this country from all identities, and to be able to channel their pain freely without, you know, being trying to be controlled, which I cannot be controlled. And so it was important for me to be a free agent, so to speak, during this election cycle. And that is exactly what I'm doing with my organization, and also being a senior fellow at the Institute on Race, Power, and Political Economy.
At the New School. We want to thank you very much for being with us. Former Ohio State Senator Nina Turner. Tune in election night, Tuesday, November 5th, for a four-hour election special here on Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Shah. I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! War, Peace, and the Presidency. On Tuesday, November 5th, I'll be joined by Juan Gonzalez, Nermeen Sheikh, and guests from around the country for a live election night special. I hope you'll tune in at democracynow.org from 8 p.m. to midnight Eastern Time for our one-of-a-kind reporting and analysis on this critical election. You're listening.